Excuse me, recordings have started.
Thank you, Anne. Well, welcome, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the review of all rights protection mechanisms and all GTLDs PDP working group call on the 12th of October, 2018. In the interest of time today, there will be no roll call. We have quite a few participants online, so attendance will be taken via the Adobe Connect room. So if you're only on the audio bridge, would you please let yourself be known now? We do have Claudio noted. All right, thank you. And as a reminder to all participants, please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. And please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll hand the meeting back over to Philip Corwin. Please begin.
Yeah, well, thank you, and welcome everyone to our final review of URS-related proposals. It appears we're going to reach our goal of completing this part of the process prior to departure for ICANN 63 in Barcelona. We have four proposals left to discuss today, three from Mr. Kirikos, one from him and Zach Muscovich jointly. Let me ask at this point whether there's anyone either in the chat room or on the audio only who has any intention of presenting a revised proposal on today's call. Okay, I don't see or hear anyone, so it looks like we've just got those four proposals. I would venture and hope that we can probably get through them in about an hour, unless one of them requires a particularly higher degree of discussion, and I'll speak a short bit at the conclusion of our presentation and discussions of the proposals to talk about next steps. And with that, I guess I turn it over to Mr. Kirikos to present under our standard format, a 5 minutes presentation, and then 2 minutes each for comments, 4 minutes response rebuttal, but we don't have to take all the time. I believe we're starting proposal number 23, so Mr. Kirikos, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Phil. George Kirikos with transcript. The brief summary of this proposal is that it's cost recovery by the registrars and the registries with regards to compliance costs. And as I noted last time, for those who weren't here, folks might want to keep an open mind on these proposals, that even if they're opposed to them, they might want to put it forward to public comment, because in the end, we want to reach consensus on policies, and policy A might not reach consensus on its own. Policy B might not reach consensus on its own, but conceivably, the package of A and B together might reach consensus. So there's going to be some give and take in the future, and keeping these proposals alive will be beneficial to get proposals through as a consensus. So briefly, the URS and URP should be updated to permit both registrars and registries the ability to recover from URS providers reasonable administrative and compliance costs. Should a provider not pay such costs, which can vary based on the number of domains involved in a dispute, the complaint shall be barred at that provider. And if commercial credit is extended to providers and payment is in arrears, complaints from that provider involving that registrar or registry would be suspended. So that's the proposal. And the rationale. Currently, the policies they allow providers like NAF in this case, to charge fees for disputes. However, they don't explicitly permit registries or registrars to recover their costs of compliance and administrative fees. And so the policies should be updated to explicitly allow such cost recovery by permitting registrars and registries to charge reasonable fees. And those would be determined by an implementation review team, but perhaps on the order of $50 per dispute plus a variable fee per domain, like $10. And if a dispute takes 30 minutes of admin time, for example, that might be consistent with a $50 charge at a typical cost of $100 per hour for labor. there's actually a Supreme Court of Canada case involving cost recovery by an ISP that was recently before the courts, and $100 per hour happened to be the same number, although it was derived independently, and that's in Canadian dollars. So that was kind of interesting. My actual lawyer was representing Rogers, the big ISP, which is kind of interesting. Anyhow, evidence in support of this proposal, I consulted with Reg Levy of Two Cows, who actually happens to be in the chat room right now, so maybe she'll be able to speak with this, and also reviewed the registration agreement of GoDaddy, and learned that a typical dispute generates about half an hour of compliance costs. I also saw that GoDaddy has attempted to shift the burden of such compliance costs on registrants. When it's really a cost that's directly generated through the interaction of providers with registrars and or registry operators, that's URS providers. Also, some disputes involve multiple domain names, so we'd have to justify a per domain name variable cost within a fee schedule for registrars to recover costs from providers. When I posted this to the mailing list back in September, there was a thread that was fairly active, and Jonathan Frost of .club posted a couple of interesting posts, which I'll link to in the chat room. And since I've got 5 minutes, I might as well read from them to use up my time so others have time to comment. He added, on top of what Reg said, the cost that the registrars, registries bear actually goes beyond what Reg has said. There are situations where we have to go to outside counsel or even ICANN to resolve ambiguities in complying with the rules. Additionally, the 24-hour action requirement locking a domain name that has received a URS complaint actually increases the resources that have to be dedicated beyond the actual number of minutes per complaint, because compliance personnel has to allocate or reserve a certain amount of time per day to perform the task, even if no complaint is received that day. And his main point was that in addition to the day-to-day time commitments, there are unpredictable legal costs associated with the administration of URS UDRP. And an additional point that I wanted to add is that if folks are familiar, the VeriSign contract would allow people to would allow them to negotiate a cost increase for .com domains if there were burdens imposed through new consensus policies. So David McCauley last week proposed extending this to legacy TLDs. So we want to make sure that any policies are cost neutral, so they can't get any benefit from raising costs on others. Thank you.
George, this is Phil. Before taking comments, and on this one I'd be particularly interested to see if there are contracted parties who wish to be noted in support. On this .com, I previously stated on a prior call, and just to reiterate, this notion that VeriSign would take any position for or against a proposal based on an that it would give us a rationale under the current contract, which may change, to petition ICANN for a cost recovery increase in .com fees, is one, it just has never entered any discussion within VeriSign's policy team of positions we should take on any of these proposals, and two, I can't envision any of these proposals would justify even a one penny increase, which would generate an additional $1.3 million per year. We're talking on any of these of potential compliance costs of in the hundreds or low thousands of dollars, not in the millions. So I would hope that that suggestion would not be repeated, because it's frankly baseless. With that, I'll call on Renee Fosen to comment.
Thank you, Phil. This is Renee Fosen for the record. Obviously, as a provider, I am opposed to this proposal. In a URS case in particular, our margins are so slim to add an additional fee that we would have to pay a registry or registrar. It's not just the fee itself. Now we've got to set up a whole new system on how we're going to pay that, and accounting is involved. There's additional steps here, so it's to collect and pay $50, it's probably going to cost us $60 or more to do that. So it's not just the $50 at that point. Additionally, in a URS case, it may be touched by both the registry and registrar. So are we doubling it then at that point? Because each will incur potentially administrative fees, so where would the line be drawn on that? And I imagine that the administration would also bear on the registry and registrars as well. So they wouldn't be collecting $50 because they're going to have some sort of a system set in place to monitor this and collect it. So they're not even seeing the money. So it's administration on two sides kind of erodes the what would be potentially the profit for anybody on this thing. And furthermore, I agree, it's the cost of doing business. I'm sure other providers would say the same thing, that we're likely absorbing some costs for some of these proposals moving forward, but there's only so many that we can bear, and I think that the registries and registrars are probably doing just fine. Yes, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Renee. Next, Jonathan Frost. Mr. Frost, we're not hearing you. Are you on mute? Do you need a dial out? Well, we're not hearing you.
No, this is Claudia. Can I get in the queue at one point?
Yeah, Claudia, why don't you speak and we'll hold a spot for Mr. Frost when he's able to dial in and be heard. He said he's redialing in the chat.
Sure.
Go ahead, Claudia.
All right, thanks. So thanks, George, for putting this forward. It's clear you put some thought into this. One question I have is, I thought I heard you say that you don't think that registrants should be paying for this cost. If your proposal is to have ICANN essentially subsidize the operations of the contracted parties, ICANN collects all this revenue, for the most part, from registrants. So I'm just seeking clarification about that particular element. Secondly, I would agree with the comments from Renee. I think when you look at registration abuse and when you look at the rights protection mechanisms, the vast majority of the cost is imposed on those that are harmed by the registration abuse. And I don't think we've seen any proposals regarding those costs. And so this would certainly open up really a Pandora's box by doing this. You essentially have ICANN subsidizing the cost of operating a business, and it's not really, as far as I understand, it's not really ICANN's role to do that, and it's really something that should be left to the market. That's my comments. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Claudio. Is Mr. Frost now available to be heard? I see that he's calling in right now. While he's calling in, I'd like to ask, I'll take 2 minutes in a personal capacity. I have two questions for the proponent. My first question is, why should the rights of a trademark owner in either URS or UDRP be dependent on the non-payment of fees if they were to be required by a third party registrar, and is there a danger that registrars might, in fact, deliberately not pay those to attract registrants who want to be immunized from a URS or UDRP complaint? And my second question is, why wouldn't we expect that if the fee, in fact, was something substantial, more than the registration fee itself, in the order of $20 or $30 or $50, why wouldn't we just expect that registrars would amend their customer agreements to require the customer to pay for that? So those are for Mr. Kirikos to answer in the response period. Do we have Jonathan Frost now able to speak?
Yes, sir. I'm on the call.
Thank you. Go ahead.
All right. This is Jonathan Frost. I'm with Dot Club Domain. I strongly support George Chirico's proposal. I mean, I think it's common sense. I think when a complaint is made with WIPO or ADR Forum, then they get paid for the work that they're doing in administering these arbitrations. And moreover, when you have a third-party subpoena to, say, a hospital for records, those third parties are able to charge private parties cost recovery costs to comply with the subpoena. And, I mean, we're very much in that same position. Just as a matter of equity, you know, I think this proposal makes sense. I'd also like to point out in rebuttal of some of the things that have been said that this is not actually going to increase the resources dedicated to these these arbitrations, because no matter what happens, the registries and the registrars are going to be allocating the same resources. It's just that they will allocate the cost more in accordance with who's expending the resources, so there aren't, you know, free riders, so to speak. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jonathan. And I'd like to just say, George, ignore my second question that I asked. In rereading it, I see that the costs would be paid by the providers, not by the contracted parties. I blame that mistake on my jet lag, having just returned from Europe last night. So I'll leave just my first question for you to respond to about why the rights of a trademark owner should be dependent on this. But we'll move on to Reg Levy of Two Cows. Reg?
Apologies. This is Reg Levy from Two Cows, and it is absolutely true that I was asked for data regarding how long it takes my team to process a URS or UDRP complaint, but this is the first time that I've seen this proposal. I'd like to support that the proposal get put out for public comment.
Okay, so noted, Reg, and again, the co-chairs have established a fairly low bar for publication for public comment, which is just adequate support. We may be at that for this proposal, but we'll see. We'll be getting back to the full working group on that. And Jonathan, your hand is still up. And Susan Payne.
Yes, thanks. Whether this goes out to public comment or not, I think if it does go out to public comment, there'll need to be some careful consideration of what exactly it is we're asking. But I wanted to take issue with what Jonathan said about, you know, drawing the analogy between a registry or a registrar and a kind of intermediary in some other circumstances. Okay, they're not a party to the UDRP and URS, and that's to their benefit, and that is one of the reasons why these dispute processes are beneficial for contracted parties in keeping them out of being sucked into court litigation. But they're hardly intermediaries with no involvement in this situation. You know, they are the ones that flog the names in the first place, and, you know, they wouldn't have some of these costs if they had better understanding of contact details for some of their clients, because, you know, it seems to me that probably some of the most difficult and time-consuming from Reg's perspective issues that they have to deal with is tracking down their customer if actually their contact details are in you know, are no longer accurate and that kind of thing. I'm mystified as to how, you know, how there can be too many really complex cases which take hours and hours of time for a registrar. But in any event, the registrar is the one who sells the names. They make the money from selling the names, and you know, and they are not, they're not an independent intermediary accidentally caught up in this.
Okay, thank you, Susan. Are there any more comments on this proposal? If not, George, you're free to say anything you want in response. I'm going to withdraw my first question as well, having thought about it some more through the fog of my jet lag, because it was based on a mistaken assumption when I first read the proposal. But you're free to add anything you wish to the discussion of this before we proceed to the next one.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Thanks, Bill. George Quick, so the transcript. It was suggested that, you know, why don't the registrars charge the registrant? And that was actually a point I did make in Section 5, that at least GoDaddy is attempting to charge registrants if there are complaints against their domain name, and that might seem to be unfair because that's a result of them not being able to charge the URS provider. And it seems to me that they're providing the service not to the registrant. This is a service they're providing to the provider, and the provider is the appropriate person. And this creates an additional burden upon the registrant because, you know, somebody can make an unsubstantiated claim against their domain name, and they're suddenly faced with a fee from the registrar. That seems to be very, you know, unreasonable and one-sided. And it's only happening because the registrar and obviously the registry as well doesn't have the ability at present to charge the URS provider for the service that they're providing to the URS provider. There's also a question about how the rights of a trademark holder could be affected by non-payment. It was a non-payment by the URS provider to the registrar or the registry for the service they're providing. All that would happen is that it's not affecting their rights at all. It means that they just can't use that provider to make the complaint. They can go to another compliant provider who is up to date on their bill payments and file the complaint through them. That seems to be, you know, reasonable given, you know, ICANN shuts down registrars and registries for non-payment. Certainly a registrar can turn off the service to a provider if the provider doesn't pay the bill. Thank you.
All right, that concludes our discussion of proposal, the first proposal. We move on to number 32, again from Mr. Kirikos. Go ahead, George.
Thanks, Bill. George Kirikos again for the transcript. This is the proposal number 32, which is the opposite of the proposal last week from David McCauley, which wanted to, you know, promote the URS as a consensus policy that should apply to all TLDs, including all gTLDs, including .com, .org, and the legacy TLDs. And it's saying that we should eliminate I propose that the URS be eliminated as a mandatory policy for new gTLDs, and furthermore that it not be a consensus policy mandated for legacy TLDs. The ERP alone is sufficient and should be focused on instead for improvement. And the rationale. Back when the new gTLDs were debated, you know, a lot of people predicted that the sky would be falling. And so that really didn't happen. So the URS should be eliminated as its purported benefits do not exceed its costs. Thus, on a cost-benefit analysis, it should be dropped. With the focus to return to the URP instead and also to focus on deterrence. So the URS was only accepted at gunpoint by the community under the UGTLD program due to exaggerated claims of an impending cyber squatting apocalypse if new UGTLDs were introduced. The program was really held hostage unless additional RPMs were added. And so like many people making predictions about new UGTLDs, the proponents of additional RPMs beyond the UDRP proved to be completely wrong about huge waves of cyber squatting. Since those past predictions were incorrect, the policy outcomes of the past that were based on and justified by incorrect expectations should now be undone. And the purported benefits of the URS really flow to a small number of very large corporations who dominate the list of complainants, who can certainly afford a UDRP. And the compliance costs on registrars, registries, and registrants themselves exceed all the benefits of the URS. And so in terms of evidence, we've got several pieces. We've got Rebecca's research. I can't put up her spreadsheet, but I linked to it in the document. Shows that 21 of the complainants accounted for 314 of the 787 non-withdrawn complaints, demonstrating that benefits flow to a really small group of large multinational companies. Furthermore, the marginal cost of a UDRP relative to a URS is relatively small, a few hundred dollars. Given there's only like 200 cases a year in the URS, paying, you know, $500 less times 200 cases is really just about $100,000 a year total saved by all these companies combined, which is really a rounding error in terms of benefits. Now, there's another benefit, which is supposed to be the speed, the rapidity of the URS. Well, let's take a look at that. Looking at National Arbitration Forum, a typical time to complete a default UDRP is on the order of, you know, 27 days. And that's only marginally slower than a URS, which is, you know, around 16 days. Thus, the purported speed benefits of the URS versus the UDRP are really small. And that's measured from the time of the complaint. You know, the domain might have been around for a year, 2 years. So we're taking a look from, at the time from the complaint. When you look at it from the lifetime of the domain name, it could be even smaller on a relatively basis. Furthermore, there's other ways to shut down abusive sites, you know, using Section 3.18 of the RIAA. There's complaints to ISPs. There's blocking mechanisms such as Google Safe Browsing. And I posted a link to this very topic today in the mailing list, which was the study by Paul Vixey regarding their research on shutting down domain names, where most of the domains they studied were shut down within, you know, 7 days. And it was on an average of like 4 hours or so mean time to the shutdown. This is called the modality of mortality in domain names, and that was by Farsight Security. And I'll post it to the chat room. And so this also avoids the issue of VeriSign potentially increasing the price through compliance of new consensus policies. So eliminating the URS, you know, avoids that risk. And, you know, while Dill and David said it's a non-issue, I'd rather have it in a contract basis. Thank you.
Kate, do we have discussion on this very non-controversial proposal?
Bill, can I get in the chair, Claudia?
No one wishes to comment on this?
Bill, can I get in the queue? Claudia. Bill, can you hear me?
Greg Shatton, go ahead, please.
Phil, this is Kathy. Claudio is trying to get in via audio and join the queue.
Greg, not hearing you. Are you off mute?
No, I heard Claudio first, so I was wondering what was going on.
Well, we're trying to figure out what's going on with Greg's audio. Let's go on to Martin Silva and reserve a spot for Greg to speak.
Can you hear
me? As we're able to hear.
Can you hear me?
Martin?
Hello, can you hear me?
Well, I'm not hearing Martin either.
Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Kind of muffled. I want to annoy you well. There's a amount of noise on the line. Yeah, staff, do we know what's going on with this audio? We have two people want to speak, and neither one can be heard.
Actually, Phil, this is Kathy. I don't know if you can hear me. You're not
also, I hear a lot of noise. Huge amount of noise.
Phil, can you hear me? This is Kathy.
Now I can hear you, yes.
Okay. You weren't hearing. I was hearing Greg. I was hearing Claudio. But I don't think you were hearing either of them. So maybe now, whatever. And
all right. Well, I'm on the phone line, and it wasn't coming through.
I know, it's very strange. So let's see if we can get, I think it's Claudio.
Oh, this is Greg, can you hear me?
Yeah, Greg, I can hear you now.
not sure what was happening before.
You, why don't, and your hand was up first. Why don't you go ahead and comment, and then we'll try to get a comment from Martin.
I just stopped hearing Phil.
All right. I'm going to, Greg.
This is Greg. Can I be heard? I heard Phil, and then they stopped hearing Phil.
Greg, this is Kathy. I can hear you. I can hear you. So if you want to go ahead, I think Phil may be getting back on. Greg?
I'll go ahead.
Yes,
one day audio will work as well as the internet, or maybe it already does. But in any case, I am opposed to this proposal. But in the question about whether it satisfies the very low bar that we've established for putting this out, one of my concerns is not necessarily with the proposal itself, although I am, violently opposed to it, but and something I'm not entirely clear about, which is what is going out to support, or for that matter, not to oppose or suggest lack of support for these proposals. Are they going to be stated just as they are on the sheets, or are all of these secondary sources asserted facts, quote unquote facts, going to be put in as well? Because then I think there's a concern about a one-sided report that just has kind of a bunch of controversial proposals and a bunch of assertions by the proponent and no statements with regard to any of the weaknesses. So it seems like either the proposal kind of goes out as it is in kind of a minimum flat facts, flat or kind of implementation, or just the proposal itself without any argument about why it's a good proposal or a bad proposal, or we hear arguments and publish arguments on both sides. So I'm curious about how we're going to handle this. Thanks.
Okay, I'll speak to that toward the end of the call, Greg. John McElwain.
Phil, it's Claudio. Can I also get in the queue? I'm not sure if you can.
Yeah, Claudio, we'll put you in after Mr. Keating.
All right.
Hi, John McElwain for the record. So kind of following on to what Greg had to say and a comment that I had towards last call, and this is not to I would be fine with this going out for public comment, so this is not to really address that, but I think this proposal is, and a few others that we've heard are out, what I've been saying is out of scope of the charter of this working group. So if you look at the charter of the working group, we're supposed to assess whether or not the RPMs fulfill the purposes for which they were created, and then whether there are any recommendations to clarify and unify the policy goals. There's a sort of another statement later on in the charter that says that we can look at improvements and modifications to the RPMs, and some of those are attached as a starting point to the PDEP working group, but only if those attached suggestions have consensus. So I think this proposal is out of scope. I don't mind talking about it, but I think this working group, taking a step back of whatever people believe in, needs to look at what have we been empowered to do, and have a discussion over the scope, because I certainly think this one is out of scope, but there may have also been others. So I hope we can address that at some point before we conclude and get into the process of writing the interim report. Thank you.
Okay, John, thank you for that comment. That's a point we haven't heard before. I will urge that the other co-chairs discuss that on our next call. You may, we'll just discuss it, but I would point out that while Mr. Curatow said this is the mirror opposite of the proposal from my colleague David McCauley, which was to solicit comment on whether URS should become a consensus policy, noting that VeriSign has not taken any position on whether or not it should, that our charter is quite clear that we should consider whether any of these RPMs should become consensus policy. So that question does not arise in conjunction with David's proposal. On to Martin Silva.
Thank you very much. Can you guys hear me? Hello?
It's muffled, and there's a huge amount of noise in the background. I don't know where you are.
Sorry, I'm actually in a coffee. Can you hear me at all, or my type is not?
Yeah, could you go ahead and speak, and we'll see if we can understand you. Otherwise, may I type it in?
I would like to challenge what John said. I think this question is inside of the scope. I think it's the core scope of this whole working group. Is this policy fit to what it was the initial intent? And I would like to at least support to see how the public feels about this. I think it's a very relevant question. Why do we have policy if it's no longer actually useful or it doesn't really feel what we thought we needed in the first place? So just that. Do you want to hear or do you need me to type it in?
Okay. It was difficult, Martin, but I believe you said that you support putting this out for public comment, and of course, if it is put out for public comment, those opposed to it, either on substance or on beyond the scope of the charter, can comment to that end. And with that, I will go on to call on Paul Keating for his remarks.
Thank you, Phil. Paul Keating, for the record. I'm on phone, but I'm able to see the screen, but not participate by computer. So I had two comments. One was a follow-up of a question previously, which is, in what format are these now going out to public comments? Are we just going to solicit public comment based solely upon the proposal? Or are we going to give, I mean, in all fairness, although I support this proposal, I think that there should be ample time to flesh out, if the evidence is to the contrary of what George has indicated, and the case can be made for retaining it, the URS, then that should be included as well, so to speak. It's kind of like the old California referendum. You know, here's a statement in favor, here's a statement in opposition, and now we're soliciting more comments. Or are we trying to solicit the opposition in the form of the public commentary? Okay, and I understand that your response to that comment was, we'll discuss it at the end of the call, but I think it would allow people to, would give people a lot more comfort, at least it would give me a lot more comfort, to understand that in advance rather than at the end of this whole process. So that's my principal comment. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Paul, and certainly a reasonable inquiry. I frankly don't know the answer. Certainly we're going to put in the initial report for public comment the original or modified text of each proposal as presented, provided that it received the low bar adequate support. I would imagine that we're going to circulate a draft of the initial report for review and comment by all the working group members before it's published for comment. Does anyone on staff who will be preparing that draft initial report have anything to add on this subject? Julie, go ahead.
Oh, thanks, Phil. This is Julie Hedlund from staff. And this is something, too, that we'll be going over again in at ICANN 63 in one of the sessions, and we did also talk about it somewhat at ICANN 62, and that's the process for developing an initial report. But to the specific question of what gets included, how things are included in an initial report, as based on working group guidelines quickly and the PDP manual, and also from recent experience with the new G GTLD subsequent procedures, PDP working group. There are several ways that proposals, ideas, options that are discussed by a working group as part of a PDP get included in initial report. They can be included as recommendations where there's strong support for something as a recommendation. They can be included as options for comment with benefits and pros and cons presented. They can be included as questions for feedback, and that where there are specific questions that are being asked in the forum for response from the public, and then also they would be included in deliberations at the least. As long as the working group is discussing the proposals, there is something that has to be reflected in the deliberations, even if there is no agreement among the working group members as to whether or not something is supported or not. And then there is the ability to just include the proposal as is, as Phil notes, as it's been presented, when it was presented to the working group. So, and if it's been modified and represented to the working group, that would be included as well. So, when the initial report is drafted, it will be read out and discussed in detail with the working group members, with ample opportunities for discussion and comment and deliberation. Usually, in fact, there are two readings of initial reports so that everybody has an opportunity to be on a call, and then there's those edits are taken into consideration, and then a final report also goes out for review. So there are several steps involved. Sorry to go on for a while, but we'll also spend more time on this at ICANN63. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Julie. Now, I'm going to call on Claudio, who's been waiting in the audio patiently, and after him, David McCauley, and after him, Greg Chatton wants to make a follow-up comment. I'll urge him to be brief in that. And Claudio, go ahead.
Thanks, Phil. Just as an initial matter, I just wanted to make a comment about some of the rhetoric that George used in presenting his proposal. I think he stated that a certain part of the ICANN community got this as part of the new GTLD program under gunpoint. And I just think we really need to tone down that type of rhetoric and sort of recognize that the concerns that stakeholders have are legitimate, and really to try to avoid using terminology like that. I also disagree with just a lot of the substantive points that George mentioned in terms of how this came about. The applicant guidebook was initially posted for public comment, and the vast majority of the comments came in expressed concern about the potential for registration abuse and a lack of protections. This ultimately went to the GNSO. The board at that time, the board chair and president of ICANN CEO sent a letter to the GNSO, which led to the STI, and this was unanimously accepted or approved by the GNSO. And so it really was the entire community that that approved the URS, and it does play an extremely important role. And lastly, just in terms of the level of registration abuse that we see in new GTLDs, they are probably at the same level as of legacy domains or even higher. And so you've seen all these different RPMs come out to help stem the problems that could result when you extend the namespace. And as a result, you've seen less registration abuse. So I think George's argument is somewhat circular in that sense when he stated that the sky was going to fall and we haven't seen these problems. Well, we've seen the development of all these rights protection mechanisms to address those concerns, and yet there's still been a lot of problems that have resulted. And so, hopefully if this does go out for public comment, any facts that George decides to put in can be, Julie
Claudio,
said, it could be a pro and con.
So I have to ask you to wrap up.
All right, I'm done.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Keating, I believe that's an old hand, if you could put it down. Now on to David McCauley. David?
Thank you, Phil. It's David McCauley speaking for the record. And what I'd like to do is reiterate two things that I put in chat about 8 or 10 minutes ago. But when I put these in chat, the chat was moving by so quickly, I think it bears repeating. And the underscoring, I thank you, Phil, for your efforts. But since I made these comments and proposals, I'd like to underscore them myself. The first is on number 32, that is the proposal that URS be eliminated as a mandatory policy for new GTLDs, I would like to be on the record as in opposition to that. Thank you. The second comment is with respect to the proposal I made last week, October the 3rd, the proposal that we seek public comment on the notion of making URS consensus policy. I do want to underscore that that's exactly what it was. The proposal is to seek public comment, full stop. VeriSign, for whom I made that proposal, has not made up its mind on the substantive issue. Should URS be made subject to consensus policy, we would do so at an appropriate future time, hopefully with the benefit of a very robust public comment discussion. But it was simply a proposal to seek public comment. Thanks very much, Phil.
Thank you, David. And now on to Greg. Greg, since this is your second comment, I urge you to make it fairly succinct.
Thanks. Greg Chatton for the record. First, I think Paul misphrased or phrased in a very different fashion what I was asking about or what I thought we were talking about in terms of pros and cons of a proposal. This is a good example. I don't think the opposite of this proposal or what needs to be presented in addition to this proposal is, and perhaps the rationales, but it is not a rationale for why the URS should be retained, but rather a rebuttal to the proposal and why it's a bad proposal and why it fails and what's wrong with it. That, you know, this is not the idea that we're going to set everything up in equipoise, that everything is kind of somehow now completely open for, you know, a discussion of as if this were an open field for discussion. You know, these are, so I think we need to be very careful when we get to the full discussion of how we're going to present these proposals, that we understand what we mean by pro, you know, statements for and against. I think you can make a statement against this proposal without having to re-defend the URS, and indeed should not be forced to have to do that, or else we're just going to rewrite, you know, 12 years of stuff, which Michael Karanikolas, even though he wasn't around for it, seems to have judgments about what's 100% accurate, which I think is really cool. Sounds baseless, but cool. And finally, you know, I think that we're in looking at this, the idea that there are a small number of large corporations that are benefiting from this and somehow that's, you know, good or bad or that's bad. We should also look at there seem to be a very small number of professional domain speculators who seem to be concerned about it. So if we want to, you know, try to quibble about, you know, who's important or unimportant, we can do this that way, but I think that's going to make this a useless process. So I think we should, you know, stick to trying to prove our points in better ways. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Greg. And is there anyone else who wishes to comment on this proposal before turning the 4 minutes back to the presenter for response? All right. Seeing and hearing no one. Julie, your hand is up. Is that an old hand or a new hand?
The old hand.
Okay. Take it down. Let's get tired being up there. All right, George, you have 4 minutes to respond as you wish.
Yeah, George Grigos for the transcript. Yeah, there are not too many points that were actually raised regarding the proposal itself. There are concerns that it might be out of scope, which I disagree with because I've actually been through a Section 3.7 appeal where things that I thought were out of scope turned out to be in scope because the scope of a PDP is relatively broad, broader than people think. And so I think that's kind of a losing argument against putting this out for public comment. The procedural questions as to what goes into the initial public report That should really be debated later because it's not really about this proposal, but I'll just take a few seconds to note that whatever standard applies should apply to all the proposals, including the sub-team proposals, which didn't have a lot of these rationales. They were like simple two or three liners without any supporting evidence, you know, a quote, a link to some, you know, footnote somewhere. So I think we should make sure that this applies to all the sub-team proposals as well as all the individual proposals so that they're all at an equal standing in terms of how the public will see a report. There's some comments about language, which I disagree with. You know, there people have a vocabulary and can understand what was meant. There were concerns that some of the proponents or opponents, were, you know, are a small number of domain speculators, which is kind of odd, saying that the representation in this PDP might not be representative. You know, people registering a small number of domains for, you know, $10 don't have the resources to debate topics that you know, will take years for a $10 domain name. You know, it's going to be tending to involve people that, you know, have a, you know, a certain amount of wealth. If you look at the participants, you know, you've got some of the wealthiest people in the domain industry that have a financial interest in making sure that the policies turn out to be balanced. And eventually this will go to public comments, and we'll see what the public thinks. The participation shouldn't be restricted based on that. If we use that argument, there are, you know, tens of millions of trademarks, and how many of those are registered by small businesses? But we have some of the largest companies like Amazon and here, you know, should Amazon be excluded because they're wealthy? I don't see that argument being made. But we actually see who uses the URS. We know from the facts that the users of the URS, not the people that are debating the policy, but the actual users of the URS are the largest companies. And so, you know, if small companies aren't using this or are using this in a very small number, as a fraction compared to the total number of trademarks, you know, let's say there's 10 million trademarks, but that the fraction of trademarks that are actually used to initiate a URS are only coming from a very small number of companies. That kind of tells you something, and so that's why I put that in. And if people want to challenge that, the appropriate place to challenge that is probably in the comments to this initial report, and not necessarily trying to debate it so that it's in the initial report as well, because other people could have put in proposals of their own, and you know, there was like 3 or 4 weeks to make these proposals, and everybody had their fair chance. Thank you.
Okay, before going on the next proposal, I'm going to take prerogative as chair to say two things. Well, first I'm going to say in a personal capacity, as someone who was very active in the STIRT, at the time it was ongoing in developing these RPMs, I remember a great deal of passion on various sides of these issues, but I don't remember there being any guns in the room or threats of retribution, violence, or apocalypse if something wasn't accepted. I'm also noting that a number of members of the working group on the call today have proposed that when we move, if we find that a proposal has achieved adequate support and is included in the working group initial report, that members be given an opportunity to challenge statements within the proposal that they feel are hyperbolic or not factual. I'm not going to take any view on that right now other than to say that I will urge that this be discussed by the co-chairs, and you know, we will communicate back to the working group long before there's any draft initial report before us. And with that, we move on, having expended, we're at 58 minutes into the first hour, move on to the third of the four proposals scheduled for today, which is, again, Mr. Kirikos's number 33. So once again, George, take it away.
Thanks, Phil. George Kirikos again for the transcript, and in support of this proposal, I'm also linking to the post from earlier today, which had a blog post from yourself from a few years ago. So this proposal is to put providers...
George, since you brought that up, I want to make clear that
can stop the clock.
I have no objection to anyone referencing anything I've ever written, but that blog post did not represent my personal views at that time or at this time. It was a post submitted on behalf of my clients at the time, the Internet Commerce Association, and my representation of them, and the fact that I used the word we in the article should make clear that the statements made then were on behalf of the ICA and did not represent my personal viewpoint then or now. Thank you.
Thanks, George Griggs, again, for the transcript. Yeah, this proposal is regarding putting providers under contract with ICANN. And so all current and future URS providers should be brought under formal fixed-term contracts with ICANN instead of the current arrangements, which are just a memorandum of understanding. And these contracts should not have any presumptive renewal clauses either. So fixed-term contract as opposed to an MOU that is basically a relatively informal and perhaps unenforceable arrangement. So the current legal relationships between ICANN and providers create uncertainty regarding accountability, transparency, and compliance. Formal contracts for a fixed term without presumptive renewal clauses will help improve the current state of affairs. Contracts will provide all parties with clear expectations of rights and responsibilities. Providers should be subject to the same scrutiny as other contracted parties, such as registrars and registry operators, to ensure that bad actors do not gain control over an ADR provider. And if you recall, Paul Keating suggested once when this topic came up, you know, what happens if a bunch of pro-respondent attorneys bought a URS provider and had all, you know, anti-trademark lawyers being panelists, that would be caught as well. So all beneficial owners of 15% or more of a provider should be disclosed. And so the current accredit and forget it model is unacceptable. These are really multi-million dollar ADR services contracts in aggregate and should be formalized with contracts. And I note for the record that, you know, Forthright, which is closely related to NAF, has a 3-year contract with New Jersey. So these are not new things. And the reason why I included the blog post from Phil is the disturbing fact that, you know, the STI unanimously agreed that providers should be placed under contract. And the board accepted all those recommendations unanimously. So why is it, and I don't care about Phil's opinions, I just care about Phil's statement of the facts. So apparently this was already a consensus policy, and yet we see that, you know, 5 years later, these providers are still not under contract. And so that's disturbing. Why hasn't staff implemented what the STI approved as a policy? And so that's why I quoted from Phil's blog post of the time. And so, that's the proposal, and I look forward to your comments and questions. Thank you.
Are you in the queue?
Yeah, Claudio, I'll put you in after Christine and before Greg. And I just wanted to make one clarification. George referred to URS as a consent policy. Of course, none of these RPMs are yet consensus policies. They are implementation details of the new TLD program as a formal matter. And I see a lot of people want to speak to this one, so let's hear from them, starting with Christine, then we'll go to Claudio, and then on down the list. Christine, go ahead.
Thanks. This is Christine, Amazon Registry. I guess I have a couple of questions back on this proposal, George. So you had said that the STI had said that the provider should be under contract. I think any lawyer will tell you an MOU is a contract. Now, you are probably going to argue that a fishing contract, which is fine, but then I think you should revise your statement that it is actually a contract. And then I think the second thing is, and I'm kind of a broken record because I've said this a done times on these calls so far, and that is, let's figure out the problem we are trying to solve here. Do we have situations? I mean, you've got lots of hypotheticals. People have come on all these calls and said something awful might happen. This awful thing could happen. I'm trying to figure out what problem we're solving. What awful thing will happen? Has anybody tried to contact ICANN compliance about a provider's behavior and been told, sorry, we can't help? Has any provider thumbed their nose when ICANN has compliance has called them to say, we had a question about something you're working on or you're doing? And what is the problem? Secondly, I don't think any provider has gone on record and said that they refused to go under any more contract. The providers were presented with something to sign and they signed it. So, I'm not sure that we're fighting a battle that's even really ours to fight. If ICANN wants to put providers under contract, that's fine. What do you want that contract to say? What are the terms that are not being met? The providers, as accredited providers, have to follow the UDRP and the URS. If they're not following the UDRP and the URS, somebody will call them or should call them and say, hey, guess what? You're not following along. Get it together. Give them a chance to get it right. I'm just not seeing how this is a current problem and anything more than sort of a hypothetical problem that could come up somewhere down the road that we need to try to prevent right now. I don't really necessarily oppose it. For the record, I'm just asking. This doesn't seem to be an issue. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Christine. On to Claudio's waiting in the audio room. Go ahead, Claudio.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. It's Claudia. And Christine actually touched upon a lot of the things I wanted to say. What is the problem? Is the problem something, if there is a problem, is that something that is solvable via contract? Is that even necessary? It would probably help in the situation to get input from ICANN.org to get a better understanding of its relationship with the providers and, you know, why it's chosen to go down this particular path. Just also to answer George's question about the STI report. So the STI report went out for public comment, and after the board adopted the recommendations, the subsequent versions of the applicant guidebook were then posted for public comment. So nothing that either the IRT proposed or the STI proposed were guaranteed to be a part of the program. They were always going to be subject to public comment. As Phil noted, they were not consensus policies. And so that is just, I hope, George, that helps clarify why the STI could have recommended something and it not ultimately ended up in the final version of the applicant guidebook. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Claudio. Greg Shatton, go ahead, please.
Thanks. This is Greg Shatton, and I'm not in favor of this proposal going out for public comment, even with the relatively low bar, because I think it is based on a false premise, which is that an MOU, and particularly these MOUs, are not formal contracts. To the extent that any document is a formal contract, it's not the name that's on it, but whether it exhibits the basic criteria by which a contract is formed. And unless George would like to provide some basis for his assertion that these contracts are not formal contracts and that these contracts are not enforceable, I think this is just based on a false premise. And secondly, it is entirely an implementation question. So, I think in this case we have a proposal that has no basis and therefore should not be put forward. George should have a chance to be fair to rewrite the proposal if there's a particular element. And maybe I'm being more than fair here, but he talks about the fixed duration. If he wants to put out a proposal, if there should be a fixed duration or some other additional criteria in the management of providers by ICANN, let's talk about that. But let's not, as with so many of these proposals, start out with a pile of fake news and then attempt to build, put a proposal on it. It's kind of the cherry on top of a dumpster fire instead of a sundae. But in any case, I will return my 15 seconds back. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Greg. Martin Silva.
Yes. Yes, thank you. I just want to say that I think this is a good proposal. I don't see what could be harmful of getting more formal contract of such an important policy. Again, of course, I would like to hear more about legal opinion of the U.S. lawyers. I know that a memorandum is a contract, of course. But it seems reasonable what Georgie is proposing.
Okay, thank you. Reg Levy, please go ahead. Reg is gone. Martin just spoke, so on to Paul Keating. Oh, wait, Reg, I see your hand back up. I don't want to take your place away. Are you ready to speak?
Yeah, my apologies. I clicked the hand button instead of the microphone button and started talking.
Okay, go ahead.
I'd like to agree with Christine. Thanks. I'd like to agree with Christine that I think most of the vendors are good actors, and I'd also like to agree with Greg that I think these MOUs are, in fact, contracts, because they're contracts. But I would like to see regular review of the vendors, I would presume that that would fall under ICANN's purview. Just to confirm that everybody's a good actor, and I see no reason that this should not be sent to public comment. Thanks.
Thank you, Reg. And I just want to take a personal note here, since my article written many years ago on behalf of ICA was mentioned. I don't recall. We could debate whether or not an MOU is a contract. I personally regard it as a type of rudimentary contract, certainly. I believe that getting a written document was regarded as something of a win by ICA at the time the MOU was put out. But and I hope that if this is put out for comment, and I think we've heard a fair degree of support, that the rather than debating whether or not an MOU is a contract, that proponents or opponents would focus more on how the current agreement, the MOU, might be changed or improved in whichever way they wish. And I would finally note that the sub-team certainly scrutinized the MOU as well as the overall rules in the applicant guidebook and policy, and have recommended compelling some of the providers, one in particular, to fulfill all of the provisions of the current document. So I'll stop there. And, Martin, I believe we already heard from you. Your hand is still up. But I'm moving on to Paul Keating and then Zach Moskovich.
Hi, thank you. This is Paul Keating for the record. So I agree with your comments about the MOU. You need to read it to see if it is enforceable and to what extent it is enforceable. Not everything in an MOU is enforceable, and it's usually intended that way by the parties. So I'm very much in favor of getting this out for public comment. In response to one of the questions which was directed at have there been any problems, as a UDRP practitioner, I can definitely talk to that. I have encountered numerous problems with providers, and none of my efforts to get them resolved by involving ICANN has led to any response whatsoever from ICANN, let alone any change to the problems. I'll give you some examples, and I'm sure Nat can talk to one of these that I'm going to speak about. I was very tangentially involved with a statistical study that Nat and Zach Moskovich did on panel selection at NEF, which showed that a very disproportionate number of the UDRP cases were going to a select group of panelists. So it led to concerns about bias, qualifications, et cetera. Why weren't the rest of the huge body of panelists being tapped for these cases? They can't all not have been available. Other instances that have come up are things like NAF's insistence on allowing supplemental filings, which place a huge burden upon respondents who have to respond to these things anyway, and cannot rely on the fact that panelists may or may not
consider the supplemental filing. Another one is delays by complainants. I've had cases where I've selected 3-member panels and the complainant has refused to pay the additional fee. And although I've requested that as a result of that, that the complaint needs to be dismissed, the provider has in both cases, once with WIPO and twice with NAF, they've just simply allowed the complainant as much time as basically they needed in order to pay the fee.
Paul, I have to interject. Your time expired a bit ago. I wonder if you could just quickly wrap up and put additional
sure.
comments either in the chat or on the working group email.
I'll wrap up, Phil. I'm in complete favor of having formal contracts with the providers at issue here, both for the URS and UDRP. There's no reason why they shouldn't be there. Those contracts should be formalized. They should deal with things like qualification of panel, method of panel selection, and a time period which there is a review and potential renewal of the contract, but not an automatic continuation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Paul, particularly for the substance you brought to those comments. Zach Muscovich, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Zach Muscovich. This issue, to me, comes up more in the context of the UDRP, the URS, for the simple reason that with the UDRP, we have absolutely no paper, but here at least we have 2 pages of memorandum of understanding. So in my view, the reason this should go out for PUNK primarily is that I hope to one day see the kind of comprehensive contractual relationships that exist throughout all other important business relationships that ICANN carries on with, you know, intricate contracts that deal with the kinds of issues that Paul mentioned that particularly have come up within the context of the UDRP, but could just as easily come up in the context of the URS. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Zach. Michael, go ahead. You're the last hand up.
Thanks very much. Just briefly, I recall that the work. Michael okay. Karanikolas for the transcript. Thank you for the reminder. I recall the work of the subteams shown non-compliance to be a problem, and I think there's substantial need for stronger accountability and oversight about how this is done. That was certainly, you know, what I came away from that process thinking, and I would welcome this proposal as a potential avenue for that. Whether it's the optimal avenue for that, whether it's the right avenue for that, whether there are better avenues, I think that remains to be seen, but I would look forward to community feedback to assess that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think we had a good substantive discussion on this. Does the presenter wish to use any of his response time?
Thanks.
George?
George Rigos for the transcript. If I mistakenly said consensus policy, I apologize. I meant to say that the proposals from the STI had unanimous consensus, period. In terms of whether this is a contract or not, I guess that's up for debate. The MOU is a contract or not is debatable. The topic of contracts has a long history. Some of the people here probably became lawyers because of the movie The Paper Chase, where contracts were a central topic taught by Professor Kingsfield. The issue with having them under a contract with their MOU is very important because we have contracts for registries. We have contracts for registrars. We have contracts for registrants, over a $10 domain. And this is a very valuable contract or a very valuable relationship for running a URS provider. And something should be, more formal than just an MOU. If you think an MOU is really good enough, then, I challenge people to say, well, why doesn't all the terms that require a registrar or a registry to adopt the UDRP and the URS, why not just put that into an MOU instead of a contract and see whether that, if that's the reasoning, or why not have the expectations of a registrant be put into an MOU and see if that's good enough. I think, that's a really weak argument that people are putting forth as a reason for not formalizing these and putting them into a contract, because they know that, when bad things happen, people raise all kinds of arguments saying, oh, well, this was just an understanding, informal. It wasn't a contract. You know, we want to have very clear expectations, and a contract does that. In terms of what that contract would do, it would set up expectations about, you know, conflicts of interest that has come up in this PDP of panelists, expectations as to, you know, who owns the provider itself. You know, we've got National Arbitration Forum with its bad history of consumer arbitration in the courts. You know, the consent agreement it signed, you know, that's not very good. We've had decisions without any rationale for the URS. We've had, you know, these copy and paste scandals that I've written about in the blogs, which aren't in evidence here in the rationale. But, you know, we've had bad behavior that, you know, needs to be monitored, at least, by ICANN for compliance. You know, we have compliance monitoring for all other contracted parties. This would be another contracted party in a different sense, but still a contract. You know, they probably have a contract for, you know, whoever, you know, is their janitor for janitorial services, custodial services at ICANN. They're held to a higher legal standard than the URS providers. That doesn't really make sense to me. So that's why I think it's important to put this out for public comment, and hopefully with all the comments we received, it met the standard. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, George. Mr. Keating, your hand's still up. I wonder if you just lower it as we get into the final proposal. And this is a joint proposal from Mr. Kirikos and Muscovich, and you can split up your five-minute presentation time and four-minute response time any way that you wish, but it's 5 minutes for both of you together, so take it away in any way you wish to. And this is proposal number 34.
Indeed. This is Zach Muscovitz. So you may recall that in one of
the
earlier...
proposal on the screen. Hold on, Zach. We didn't have the proposal on the screen yet. I wanted to make sure it was up there. Okay, so there's a merger of two other proposals. Go ahead.
Yeah, I you know, as an aside, I would say that it would be great if we ever had the opportunity to discuss these proposals in Barcelona, that it be done over drinks. It would be a much more pleasurable experience than the way we've been handling it thus far. But in regards to this particular proposal, you may recall that a couple calls ago, there were two proposals on the issue of the language of the U.S. proceeding. The one that I had made had a more complex solution to it that was based upon the lack of justification for the current rule, which is that all the complaints must be in English. And so without a sufficient justification, in my view, for complaints being in English, what alternatives should there be? Well, the proposal I had originally raised was to look at the language of the trademark itself, the location of the registrant, the location of the registrar, things like that. But upon hearing the feedback of this group and also seeing George's proposal, which was to just mirror the language of the UDRP with some minor adjustments, as I'll outline momentarily, I was persuaded that although not in my view as satisfactory as my own proposal, seems to be a simplified and more moderate compromise solution that I've come to support. So George and I collaborated on the writing of this particular proposal, and what it does is just to say that rather than have the complaint be required to be in English, that the complaint be in the language of the registration agreement, which is the standard rule that the UDRP has employed for the past nearly 20 years. Added on to that is a sub-solution, and that's that, you know, a complainant may want to bring the URS proceeding in a language other than the registration agreement for a good reason. And if a complainant wants to do that, it should be given an opportunity and not have to use up its 500 words of the U.S. complaint. So the second part of this proposal is to allow a complainant to make its case in up to 250 words that the
the complaint should be in a language other than the standard registration agreement. And as a corollary to that, a respondent, too, may for whatever reason have a good explanation about why it wishes the proceeding to be in a language other than in the registration agreement, and it, too, should be given the opportunity in 250 words or less to make its case. The last point I'll make is that no translations are required to be filed by the parties, provided that they bring the complaint in the language that the panelist confirms is going to be the language of the proceeding. There's a minute 54 left. I defer to George if he has any remarks he'd like to make on this. Thank you.
George Kourikos here for the transcript. Yeah, thanks. I'd like to thank Zach a lot for all the time we spent reviewing all the prior call. We spent several hours doing that and looking at all the comments. So the adjustments to the UDRP rules that we made accommodate many of the comments that we received in the presentations that we each made previously. And so the word limits especially, and also that the translation might end up being longer once you translate it than the 500 words. So we wanted to make sure that possibility was accounted for in the policy. But yeah, thanks again for Zach for all the time we spent working together. It was a pleasure working with them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the presentation. Just to clarify, this combined number 34 supplants and replaces number 24 and 25, and they're no longer in play. Is that correct?
George here, yeah. This would definitely be a replacement for both policies. Actually, I did want to add one additional point. I still had a minute left. I just noticed one more thing. In terms of implementation, which Zach didn't mention in the Section 4 of the rationale, we wanted to make it very clear that the URS providers would not be required to provide translations of the pleadings. It's always going to be up to the complainants, like the parties, to do the translating. And so that was a question that somebody had raised in the prior calls, and we've addressed that in the rationale. Thank you.
All right, thank you, George, for that clarification and response to my request for clarification. Renee Fossum, go ahead.
Hi, Renee Fossum for the record. I guess I just have a couple of questions. The first is the language of the registration agreement, which I think as a provider I don't have a problem with, but I thought if we were protecting the rights of the actual registrant, as it's written now, it's the language of wherever the registrant is located. So how is that protecting or providing any service to the registrant? And the other question I have is that if the panel can order that translations be made, that's going to add time, and I wondered if you had any ideas on how that was going to be addressed. And I do apologize if it was included in the documentation that I haven't yet looked at. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Renee. Do we have other comments on this proposal regarding language of the proceedings? Christine, go ahead.
Thanks, Christine, Amazon Registry Services. I would just like to propose that the offers of this proposal also include, and I did put this in the chat, but I'll say this now, the cost not only to the complainant to translate into whatever language the proponents of this proposal have deemed requirements, but how all of the providers communicate if they're going to be expected to hire someone who speaks every global language, or how they will translate all of the sort of form cover letter type documents that go along with everything, or instructions, and how many languages everything should be translated, and how many days or weeks do you plan to propose to extend every deadline and timeline within the URS in order to allow people to get these translations made in under $1,000 or $1,500 per document. So if you could address those in the proposal, and then how much you think filing fees might go up to take that into account, that would be great. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Christine. Do we have other comments on this? I don't see any hands up. Well, George, you get a rebuttal period.
Right, I was just queuing up for that in case.
You get that without having to put your hand up. It's automatic for you and Zach. All right. Well, seeing no other requests to comment, George and Zach collectively have 4 minutes to respond to anything that was said or to add anything further on their proposal.
George here, George Rikos here for the transcript. I'll defer to Zach in the last 2 minutes, but I think there was some confusion. We made it very clear that the providers would not be doing the translation. So there were questions about having that be a factor that was just incorrect. In terms of protecting the registrant, in terms of the language, the UDRP rules actually fully accommodate that, because which we addressed as part of this, the first part of the proposal. We assume that any registrant understands the language of the registration agreement. That kind of almost goes without saying. Otherwise, why would they use that registrar? To suggest otherwise means that a registrant is entering into an agreement with a registrar that they've never read and can't understand, which would, well, you know, might happen from time to time, but would be kind of shocking. And in terms of providers having to understand every possible language, that hasn't been a very high burden in terms of the UDRP. This is, again, you know, basically matching the UDRP language, so I don't see that as an issue either. In terms of filing fees, no effect, because as we said, the provider would just not be responsible for the translations. In terms of the time limits for translation, that would be really up to the panel and the provider to work out in terms of their supplemental rules. I don't see it as something that we necessarily have to put into the policy itself. I'll defer the remaining time to Zach if he has any thoughts as well.
Thank you, Zach Muskovich. So really, the way to look at this is that whatever inadequacies, if any, exist in the way the UDRP handles language are going to be reflected in the URS pursuant to this proposal. It's nothing new at all. So in terms of how registrants are protected, the registrants are protected in two ways. And the first way under the URS is that the notice of complaint is going to be in the language of the registrant. That doesn't change. NAF wouldn't have to do anything new in that respect. What would have to be done differently is that panelists would have to be prepared, and NAF and other dispute resolution providers would have to be prepared to point panelists to hear cases in the language of the registration agreement, which is precisely what they're equipped to do now for the UDRP. In terms of translation costs, it's the same thing as with the UDRP. Nothing's different. If a complaint gets submitted in a language that's different from the preceding language, it's up to the complainant to translate it. Same with the respondent. So I don't see any substantial differences in that respect. Don't see any differences in costs. It's just aligning the URS with the way the UDRP currently is, which is a net increase in the fairness to the parties. Thank you.
Okay, that concludes our consideration of all the remaining individual proposals for operational or policy changes to the URS. I asked at the beginning of the call whether anyone had a revised proposal they want to discuss today, and heard none. So I'm going to make a few brief comments and then see if my I know Brian Beckham's not on the call today. I was just with him in Geneva at the WIPO, the main name workshop. I know he's very busy this week. I'm going to make a few remarks and then see if Kathy Kleiman, the other co-chair or staff, has anything they wish to add to them. But first I want to thank everyone. The co-chairs have been under continuing and persistent pressure from council to maintain the timeline for this working group, and we set a goal of concluding all discussions of URS proposals from the sub-teams and individual working group members to conclude prior to Barcelona. We have now achieved that goal. I want to thank everyone for their cooperation and hard work in helping us meet that goal, and that will allow us to move forward to the next steps of the working group's efforts when we get to Barcelona. The co-chairs will be meeting early next week to discuss finalization of the Barcelona agenda. You've already seen some information about it. We'll be getting back with full information about the sessions there and what will be happening there. I believe, for one thing, we're going to begin discussing the results of the analysis group surveys, but we'll provide all of that detail to you before anyone goes to Barcelona or gets ready to dial in and get online to participate in Barcelona remotely. We've heard some discussion. We've heard a number of people say about various proposals that they don't favor putting them out for public comment. I'll be frank, the co-chairs adopted the fairly low bar of demonstration of adequate support for a proposal to be put out for public comment in the initial report for a number of reasons. One, had we set a higher bar, it would have been very difficult to meet the timeline because we would have spent a great deal of time debating not just the proposal, but whether it had met the requisite level of support once it got to a higher point, not consensus, but something beyond adequate support, which means that more than proponent and one or two other people supported, that it's got some basis of backing in the working group. Second, we have a working group membership of about 150 people. We average 25 to 30 on any given call. A few more will chime in after the fact on something that was discussed on a call. We didn't think it was proper to let 20% of the working group decide 100% of the decisions on what would go out for public comment. We also thought it might be beneficial to put things out for public comment to get a much better feel for how they fared in terms of support and opposition from the entire ICANN community beyond the ranks of this working group. And also we thought that members of the community, that all wisdom does not reside within the membership of this working group, that people might chime in with suggestions for making the proposal better and more likely to achieve consensus. Looking forward, when we get past the initial report and the public comments, it's going to be stepping through the looking glass and things will change completely. At that point, proposals which demonstrated a lack of support, a high degree of controversy, a very high level of opposition. It's the personal view of this co-chair that proposals which have demonstrated a distinct lack of probability of achieving consensus after further discussion, that the working group shouldn't spend a great deal of time on them unless the proponents are willing to make some very substantial changes in response to the public comment. So while we have a very open process now for what's going into the initial report, what will be included in the final report as recommendations to be considered by the GNSO Council and the ICANN Board under the current PVP working group operating procedures are only those proposals which receive full consensus or consensus, and we'll just see where that falls. And with that, I note George has his hand up, but first I'm going to call on my co-chair, Kathy Kleinman, to see if she wants to add to anything I've said, agree, disagree, amplify, and also see if staff wants to say anything about the process going forward. Kathy, anything to add?
Hi, Phil. Yes, this is Kathy. I just want to make sure you can hear me. I'm on audio now.
Yeah, we hear you.
Okay, so great. Thank you. Thank you. Let me echo your thanks to the working group. It's been a tremendous amount of work going through first the sub-team proposals and now the individual proposals. And I know on our last call we went through a whole bevy of them, and we did it very, very quickly and with a lot of substance and context. So my thanks to everybody. Phil, just a quick note. I think staff may have some additional materials to share today regarding the Barcelona meeting, at least an overview. So I wanted to let you know that. I think now that we have set this low bar, and there were different opinions on that, but now that it's been agreed to, the question is how the individual reports the initial report, sorry, separates really, you know, how it presents these things. And I would suggest, and I have suggested, that it might separate proposals that come in, with, like the subteam proposals that have moved forward, that have come in with a lot of data, a lot of review, a lot of discussion, and frankly, a lot of consensus, although I use that word loosely in this case, that might be in a different part of the initial report than certain individual proposals that where the proponents themselves have characterized them as straw men. So they're not well fleshed out. They're kind of ideas that people are seeking input in response to. So, you know, how, and I know staff have some ideas about this. I know that they've got lots of templates and models from other initial reports and other working groups in mind. But I would think this is something we should all be thinking about as we go into the Barcelona meeting, whether we're there in person or by remote participation, is how we set up that initial report to reflect. My understanding from staff is that they will be reviewing the discussions, both the transcripts, so what was said on the calls, as well as what was said in the chat room. A lot of substance was posted in the chat room, which we all appreciate. And that it's my understanding, but then I'll let staff speak for themselves if they want, or later in Barcelona, that there will be a balanced discussion. I apologize, there's a call beeping in on my phone now, but that there will be kind of a reflection with these initial proposals and other proposals of discussions on both sides, concerns as well as support, and that staff will be drawing from the discussions of this working group. Thanks. Back to you, Phil. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy, and thanks for mentioning, because I forgot to, that the co-chairs have asked staff to get back to us to review the chats, the transcripts of the calls, and to get back to us with their estimation of which of the proposals received adequate support. And we're going to share all that with the working group for its response. We're a long way from publishing that initial report that's projected for the end of the first quarter of next year, about March 2019. So everyone's going to have a lot of time, and no one's going to be surprised by what's in that initial report. I've seen in the chat some folks who think we're being too permissive with what might be put in the initial report for public comment. I've explained the co-chair's reasoning, you know, that is, we put that out early, and it seemed to be accepted by the working group at that point. I think in the end, it's going to be more efficient than if we had set a high bar that something must demonstrate, for example, not consensus, but majority support, notwithstanding significant opposition, and we could have spent many more weeks to whether or not any particular proposal had met that, but I think it's going to be very clear once we see the public comments which proposals are capable in their original form of achieving consensus. I suspect it will be a small minority of the ones that have been submitted from all sides of the issue, but maybe I'll be surprised. And with that, I see we're at 42 minutes into the second hour. I see Mr. Kirikos's hand up. Go ahead, George. I hope it's a short comment so we can wrap up shortly. Thank you.
George, for the transcript, yeah, I see some really colorful language in the chat room about people, you know, opposing various proposals, calling them unicorns and spaghetti or whatever. I just want to remind people that, and disagree with what Phil said earlier about some topics or proposals being unviable on their own and then not worthy of further consideration. I disagree with that for the reason that I mentioned earlier, that some proposals on their own might not be able to reach consensus, but when combined with a balancing proposal, could be. For example, there was a lot of opposition to the idea of loser pays, which some people feel is very, very important, and some people feel should be, you know, should never happen. But then other people, for example, are very passionate in favor of a statute of limitations, but other people are equally passionate against it. But if you bundle those two together, conceivably, you know, those might work. Or some people might want consensus policy for URS for legacy TLDs, and they might be able to trade that off. Well, we'll take that if you have a statute of limitations or some other proposal that they don't necessarily like, but when combined together, they say, yeah, we like that. It, you know, meets the needs of both sides. So I think people should keep an open mind, and once we hear from the entire community, we'll probably be in a better position to find that balance. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, George. And just to note that you may remember, and other working members may remember, that very early on in our work in the first year of this group, I don't remember exactly when, I shared a personal view that members should be realistic, that the things that could achieve consensus would be incremental and not revolutionary, and that members should be willing to engage in some horse trading on related issues as a possible way forward. So I never meant to imply that some negotiating might not be useful, but that requires the will of working group members to do so. And Greg, go ahead. This may be the last word if no one else raises their hand.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. There's a concern raised, and I think you alluded to it, that perhaps some of these proposals are in here, or we're being encouraged to keep them in here for purposes of horse trading, and it sounds like not horse trading on related issues, but horse trading on unrelated issues, so kind of more like, you know, a prisoner swap rather than any sort of negotiation on the merits. So I'm concerned that perhaps the idea of horse trading has led to stuffing the stable with horses, unicorns, donkeys, and the like, and the idea is that they, you know, that because they're in the stable, somehow they've attained value. Perhaps this is proposal speculation or proposal investment in a way. While we have agreed to the very low bar, perhaps, of publishing these things, the idea that that gives them somehow some sort of credibility, or that they have, by being published, need to kind of be given weight in the long run, you know, is that assumes something that's not in evidence. And if that is the case, then I think we need to rethink what's going into the proposal. Can't have it both ways. If we're going to throw basically anything and everything into the proposal that didn't meet a very low bar, then the fact of the matter is that some of those proposals are in fact in there because, you know, they're not because they're broadly based or have any broad agreement or even strong support, but they just are not massively, they're not unanimously opposed. So that seems to be our basis. Let's not give them any more viability than they already have. Thanks.
You know, Greg, let me just ask you something. I don't want to dismiss your comments. You clearly, there's other people who, on reflection, now that they've seen the proposals, would like a higher bar. You know, the working group can do what it wishes. The co-chairs are here for administrative purposes. The working group members decide the substance, including procedural substance. But I'm just going to ask, if adequate support, if working group members want a higher bar, I'm going to ask two questions as a co-chair. One, what would the higher bar be for inclusion in the initial report for the solicitation of public comments? And two, and this is one I'm really interested in the answer, having been co-chaired another working group where I and the other co-chair were accused of trying to push a particular result or suppress particular proposals or whatever. Who's going to decide that? Who's going to decide, given the amorphous nature of this process and the fact that we don't vote, and even if we did vote, we couldn't vote by just numbers of working group because we have to take weight that for the various interests they provide. Who's going to decide, for purposes of soliciting public comment, whether something has met that higher standard? I have a real concern about the co-chairs being criticized for letting a proposal in or for not letting a proposal in for public comment, whereas when we're dealing with just achieving consensus, it's pretty clear when something hasn't achieved consensus if there's a bunch of people screaming about it. So I'm, you know, the working group can set a different standard of that its will, but I'd be interested in hearing what members of the working group who are unhappy with the bar we've set, what bar would they set, and who's going to be the decision maker? Because this co-chair does not want to be in the position of being shot at from both sides on the decision on any particular proposal. Thank you. And I don't expect an answer from anyone immediately. We can discuss this on the working group list, but if you don't like adequate support as a standard, propose another one and tell us who's going to, how we're going to decide whether it's met the test. Thank you. George, a brief comment, please. And then we can shut the call off unless others want to comment.
Yeah, George, we're just here for the transcript. Yeah, I just wanted to note that the co-chairs already decided on a process, and they made that process even multiple times. And so at some point, there was finality. And usually you have finality before you see the proposals, you know, and before you vote. Not vote, but before you see the level of support. This is kind of trying to change the rules after you've already seen things in order to, you know, affect the outcome. You know, we've gone through this process with the understanding, you know, of what the process is going to be, and now people want to change it again after they've seen actual support levels. So it's kind of like, you know, where does it end? Thanks.
Okay. Cynthia, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Cynthia. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. George, your point is well taken, but I will be honest with you that I was not aware of how all of the proposals that were presented would be changed and would interact with one another. It's from the beginning of the process to know how this was going to work out. At this point, I've changed my mind on a couple of the proposals from the moment that I saw them based on, you know, what came up in the chat. And I think that it's difficult to say that, you know, that what we said in the beginning, it should be immutable. I think at this point it might be a good idea for us to have a more defined consensus or bar for what goes out. And I understand the difficulties of the co-chairs in trying to make that determination. So I've suggested in the chat that we do a poll gauging support from 1 to 10 of the members so that we can actually see what the support is, not just yes or no, but on a sliding scale and make a determination from there. Good luck splitting that hair, everyone. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. John McElwain?
Hey, John McElwain, for the record. So I don't know if this is really the right part of the charter to be looking at. Obviously, I've been looking at it, and in it, it says that any further modifications, additions, and deletions concerning the RPMs that we're looking at should be determined by consensus of the working group. So I think the standard pursuant to our charter is just whether there's consensus within the group to put it out. Again, I probably need to look into it a little bit more, but I think that that's sort of the guidance we've been provided. Thank you.
All right. Well, John, that's certainly consensus. It's certainly the standard for recommendations in the final report. I would, from my own personal perspective, if we were requiring consensus to be demonstrated for any of these individual proposals to be included, to be put out for public comment, almost none of them would be put out for public comment. And that's the co-chairs didn't want to set a standard that would, you know, allow a small segment of this working group deciding what the broader community could weigh in on, both pro and con, and with suggestions for modification. But again, if the working group wants to further debate this, we're not going to stop them. Christine, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks. This is Christine, Amazon Registry. I just, you know, in addition, since it looks like we're throwing out a couple of ideas, you know, we have the of course, the original, which is sort of very low bar. Everything gets posted. Cynthia put in a suggestion about ranking, which I think is definitely something that's interesting and I think could work. I think that, you know, a couple mentioned in the chat, I wanted to get it into the transcript, that, you know, there's the idea of, and the way the sub-pro sort of did it was, they said, and I know Julie, I think, alluded to this before, is, you know, the initial, there are some sort of initial things that are recommendations, and then there are initial questions. So maybe part of the problem is we're calling them proposals versus questions or, And then I'm wondering, and I think Cynthia or someone else, I mean, people have mentioned it multiple times. There's a possibility, like a debate, right? Here's a proposition. You know, you get, you know, so many words to say for, so many words to say con. Like, come up with the best arguments for why a get for and against. And that way, at least people writing public comments can know what the working group considered. SubPro did that a little bit when they said some working group members thought this, some working group members thought it would cause a problem with that. And so maybe I'm just building a little bit more on what Julie had said, but I think if you provide that information, at least you can call out big concerns. Otherwise, you've got people having to respond to a very long, complicated public comment, which we just did for SubPro. And they've got to weed through which things, like, actually have been thought through and fleshed out and are implementable today versus which things are going to require 1 or 10 years of work to be implemented. So I think that maybe we need to think a little bit about some various options. Thanks.
Okay. You know, thanks. Those were good thoughts. And as I said, we can discuss this further, especially in terms of the procedure for how we put these out. It's not necessarily a black and white decision. Is something put out for comment or not? It may be about how it's put out for comment. And again, we're going to have plenty of time to discuss the text and what's in the initial report before it's published at the end of March next year. Mr. Keating.
Thank you. Paul Keating for the record. I am opposed to making our preliminary report review process longer and more more conflicting than it needs to be. So my proposal is that these proposals or suggestions or however you want to describe them get submitted for public comment. We then take in the public comment without trying to guide it one way or the other, because then we'll just get bogged down in discussion about the text of how this summary reads in favor, how this summary reads opposed. I think it should just go out there, and anybody, including members of this working group, can provide the commentary that they want because they're part of the public. But I very much agree and second Phil's initial comment, which was we shouldn't presuppose that we are representative of the public at large. Because we are, by and large, we have our own reasons for joining this working group and participating in them. And we come along with that kind of baggage with us, all of us do, including myself. So I would be opposed to any form of attempt to rank, score, characterize the proposal other than what it is. If it's met the low bar that we've already agreed should be the low bar, then that's it, and it goes out for the public comment. Once we get the public commentary back in, we can then have discussions about whether or not, you know, to what extent we're accepting the public commentary, whether the public commentary itself is rational, logical, based in fact, whatnot. All those things can be debated after the fact. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Greg, I see your hand up again. Go ahead.
And Kathy in the queue on audio. Thank you.
Okay, Kathy, right after Greg.
Thanks. So, Greg Chatton for the record. First, I think it's important, since this is a report that is coming from the group, even if it's not a report of consensus proposals, that we find some way to both have the comments and the support and the lack of support expressed both qualitatively and perhaps quantitatively. I'm open to discussing that. I'm not haven't made my mind up if that's, you know, a good idea, but on a latter point, but qualitatively, you know, just putting out basically what would be kind of like a series of complaints if this were without answers, if this were a judicial proceeding, basically everything that we're going to put out a bunch of one-sided stuff, and it could be one side of both side of the other, one side or the other. I'm not arguing in favor of any side in this, but I think that it's generally done in reports where there is either a lack of consensus or there are, you know, stated problems, even if it's not a final report and there's not a formal minority statement, to have some reflection of opinions that did not carry the day. And in fact, since none of these proposals have actually carried the day, then I think the views of all on the proposals are equally relevant in terms of public comment. We could also just decide that we're going to put out the proposals just as being coming from their authors indicating no support beyond themselves or the group that proposed it, whatever it may be, and, let people see that. But I think we need to be very clear about what we're sending out and make sure that those who are seeing it are very clear about what we're sending out and what it represents as a report, where people do expect at least some form of gathering consensus, although I think we won't be the only report coming out kind of in this cycle that reflects more of an early stage spaghetti fight than it does a consensus. The subsequent procedures report is proposals that came straight out of work tracks that were never debated in the full group. So there's another example there of something that is not really, that is kind of even before a preliminary report. We just need to be clear that what we're putting out is a bunch of stuff that's been floated. And if we want to indicate the greater or lesser support of various proposals, that's something to consider. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Greg. I'm going to note we're at the top of the hour. We've consumed 2 hours. Kathy has a statement. It's clear that what's in the report and how it's characterized. And by the way, we have comments from staff in the chat that they always try to reflect the deliberations in the narrative of the report. There's going to be a clear delineation in the report between sub-team proposals and individual proposals, and the individual proponents, of course, will be listed. But we're going to have a lot of time to massage how this is presented and what was asked the community to do on these proposals in terms of comment. We have many months before it's going out to solicit public comment, and there's 40 days, almost 6 weeks, for the public to prepare those comments. So, Kathy, I don't see any more hands up, so you have the last word, and then we're done in terms of meeting until we get to Barcelona, Spain.
Terrific. I love having the last word. Thank you, Phil. So first, to all who said that there are arguments on both sides of these individual proposals and that we should be capturing them, I fully agree. I don't know if I'm having some audio problems. Phil, I did just want to share something that we discussed in the last call where I knew you and Brian were busy in Geneva, but we discussed that we don't have much time, and so I just wanted to make sure that you knew that that was on the table from last time, is we talked with staff, we asked staff to talk with us. We have no more meetings after Barcelona designated on the URS. So the sense was to keep on our timeline, we really do have to put this initial report to bed. At least the outlines of it, the framework of it, within Barcelona. So we are on a timeline. It puts us on more of a crunch, I think. I do think. And I wanted to say that unless that contradicts me, I think the first session in Barcelona may be the perfect time to continue this discussion. Thank you very much.
Okay, Kathy. Thank you to everyone who participated in this call and prior calls. And once again, we all get to take a victory lap for having completed at least consideration of all the URS proposals prior to heading for Spain, and the saga will continue there. Have a great weekend, and if you're traveling to Barcelona, have a safe journey, and I'll see you there. Goodbye.
Thanks, everyone.
And that concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.